volunteer with the University of Wisconsin Oral History Department. It is April 13th, 2004. And with me is Dr. David Slaughterback, who was chairman of the Department of Anatomy at the University of Wisconsin. And we welcome you, David, and we want to hear about your life, starting right at the beginning.
The beginning of life?
The beginning of life, where you were born, and a little bit about your family.
Well, I was born in Indianapolis, Indiana. My family were members of the Friends Society. My father was an automobile dealer, and mother had 2 years of training to be a teacher. She never really did that until years later. And she was a member of a fairly, she was an only child, but her mother was a member of a very large family. And my father was one of three children. When I was born, he had already been through three failed businesses. And within 10 months, we were moved to Benton Harbor, Michigan. My father got a generous loan from a friend of his, and he set up a General Motors dealership in Benton Harbor and was tremendously successful. It took three times and then he hit it on the fourth run. That was a very nice small community. It has a partner city across St. Joseph River, St. Joseph, Michigan. They were very middle class community. They increased enormously each summer when an influx of tourists from Chicago came in. Chicago was our sort of criterion for what a large city ought to be, but then we didn't know any other large city, so it wasn't hard to have Chicago. My dad would drive us into Chicago maybe two or three times a year where there were relatives of my mother. And so very much in my memory, Chicago is identified by the lions in front of the Art Institute. And I have many times in those years sat on those lions and waved to the world out there. So we were introduced to art very early. I don't think I understood what I was looking at all. But by the time I was eight, my parents were close to divorce and completed a divorce in the summer that I was nine. Mother then took custody of my sister and myself. They were just the two of us. And we spent a year in Kalamazoo while mother really did 2 years of credit toward her bachelor's degree in one. And came out in the summer of 1936, where there were no jobs really any place. So she struggled a bit, and by the end of the summer, she had found a job in North Central Michigan, a very small village. She was to teach. There were just two rooms in the new school building, and I was put in her class, which was a terribly unfortunate situation. I could scarcely breathe but what I was being criticized for throwing things at the girls or whatever it was I was doing that was naughty. I remember that classroom particularly because there were kids of all kinds of ages. I must have been fourth, fifth, and sixth grade or something like that. And the guy who sat in back of me had a particular penchant for raw onions, and he would eat raw onions all during the class. And I would complain to my mother about that, but there's no way she was going to oblige the son in her class, because that would look like a prejudiced situation. We were there for only a short time. She got a job in a neighboring community in Fremont, Michigan. These two communities are only 7 miles apart, and they're just east of Muskegon, so it's really central Michigan. And it's also the area where there are a very large number of Dutch Reformed churches with people of Dutch heritage who had moved to this country for that purpose. And Fremont was about two-thirds made up, the population about two-thirds of those people who were, we would call them today fundamentalists. They were very strict people. And Mother's job was called Opportunity Room. And in her classes were placed students who were described as incorrigible or physically or mentally disabled. I don't think we used quite such nice language in those years, but that's what it was. And she taught that class for several years. And again, I was stuck because the upper elementary grades and the high school were in the same building, and I could never get away with anything at all. But I tried, so I didn't just give in to the situation. That really was where I grew up, and my closest friend, and still is a Native American from that community, and we were able to create a kind of existence totally independent of the very rigid culture imposed by the church members in that community. And I think it was a pretty normal growing up. I had the biggest misfortune of that time, and still haunts me to this day, so I bring it up, is because Mother was determined to advance me more rapidly than I should have been advanced. And when I was in the fourth grade in Holton, the little town where she had her first job. And when we moved to Fremont, she insisted with the superintendent of schools, who worked in the same building, that I be skipped into the last half of the sixth grade. Well, that worked sort of all right, except that that happened to be, in those years, the time when people learned fractions. And to this very day, whenever I see a fraction, I immediately convert it to a decimal point, because it just bothers me to have to deal with fractions. So when I got to physics at the university, that turned out to be a real problem, because in those years, physics problems were almost always done in fractions instead of decimals. So anyway, we were there. I graduated in 43 from that high school. There were 70 people in my graduating class. I still keep in touch with some of them. I went to the University of Michigan and had a terrible time. It was the kind of school I had been in Fremont was it was a funny situation. My mother said to me, "Don't bother to study. It doesn't matter that you read anything. You have natural ability, and that's all that matters in the world." And I've never yet figured out what natural ability is. But I was actively discouraged from studying, and it didn't matter very much, because most of the kids in the class were just marking time till they could get on the dairy farm or in the dirt farm with their families. So it didn't take, I guess all it took was what Mother called natural ability to do okay at that school. But it really hit me hard at the university, and I struggled a lot and had significant academic problems at the university. And after I had, the war had, of course, started by that time. I went on the accelerated program in 1943, so we were going 12 months a year. And that was sort of a drain, especially since I had no idea what I was doing there. My mother was determined that I would pursue a clinical degree, and I really wasn't interested in doing that. Things went along, though, with a lot of academic troubles, and I was getting more and more unhappy that I was not, my friends were all in the Army or the Navy, and I just thought that was terrible. My mother was back in Fremont convincing the draft board that I shouldn't be drafted, and I kept telling the draft board I would please like to be drafted. So I just stopped fiddling around, and I went off to the Army and was there for a couple of years. We were to be sent to Japan, and I was on a troop train going through Miles City, Montana, when people came rushing out to the train shouting that we had bombed Japan in some way that none of us understood at all. So I got to the Philippines, where I spent another year and a half, really right after the truce hadn't been signed yet, but really right after the end of the war. And there were still a lot of guerrillas in the woods, and I was assigned, I had been a machine gunner and heavy weapons platoon in the Army, but they looked at the courses I had been taking at the university and decided to put me in a medical dispensary. So I served most of my time there learning how to do stuff that any clinical lab did in those years. Came back, had a whole new vision. I've heard a lot of my peers say the same thing, that it took the Army to grow them up. And I had been heavily dominated by my mother, and I finally, spending 2 years away from her, it got to be a lot easier to say no to mother. So I came back with real enthusiasm and did very well in school and branched way out into things I was not supposed to take. I took a lot of philosophy and things of that sort. But also I got in, I had taken every course the zoology department offered. So I began to get involved with people who were nominally in the zoology department, but were very heavily engaged in research, both of many different kinds. And I did a summer study with some people doing phospholipids, blood phospholipids, and that I really got excited about biochemistry and did advanced studies in biochemistry. But oddly, most important was a class I took, which I only took because I guess it was the only one left in the zoology department, and I wondered why I was doing this. I was so much more interested in the philosophy courses I was taking. But I took a course in malacology, that is the study of snails and clams and those invertebrates. Well, I learned stuff that was fun and stuck with me all these years. But the important thing was that my professor, I had the professor to myself. I was the only one taking this class. And he had been heavily involved with educators at Harvard, and he talked to me a lot about education and theory. And I kept saying to him, I'm not interested in education. I don't ever want to teach anybody anything. All I really want to do is look at cells. I've learned how exciting cells are. And so he would challenge me. And all my life, challenge has been what I like best. And so he would make me defend my position, and then he would tell me how he could advance my study of cells. Well, by the time I had done that, I was nearly finished with my master's degree there. And oddly, at the University of Michigan at that time, there was only one Excel person, and he had just announced that he was going to retire. So, and Henry van der Schelle, who had been my malacology professor, had helped me to understand that that cells is where my life was going to be. So I thought, well, I can't stay here. I had $400 of mustering out pay from the Army, so I went to the graduate school library where they had catalogs from a wide variety of places, and I just kept looking for something that said cell physiology on it or cell something. Cell biology hadn't been invented yet as a name for anything. And came across this catalog from Wennergren's Institute in Stockholm and thought, wow, that sounds exactly like what I want to do. I wonder if they would let me in. And so I wrote to them and they said, oh, sure, by all means, come right ahead. So I went home and announced this to my mother, and I thought she was as close to death as she would ever be. But she finally realized that she had lost control. So I went over there and had an absolutely wonderful year learning how to be a scientist, learning how to do research. I worked with a histochemist for the first half of the year and with a biochemist for the second half of the year, and lived in a family where they didn't speak English, and I learned to speak Swedish and to see a lot of Sweden in a time when there were many foreign students there studying the government, because it had become a very popular issue. And so I was heavily involved with these various students from around Europe and elsewhere who were there mostly to study government. But so my life began to expand drastically.
Yeah. Excuse me. Good. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Could we go
rambling
back
on with too many?
No. This is just fine. But for the sake of this wonderful woman who's going to be transcribing some of this, would you spell that course that you took that had clams and?
Oh, malacology. M-A-L-A, mala, C-O-L-O-G-Y, malacology.
Thank you.
Mollusks. It's the word derived from mollusk.
Now, you don't have your Army service on this sheet at all.
Oh, I left it off.
You left it off your curriculum vitae.
Well, I have it on another version. I thought I had to retype this one because it was sort of old, but I must have left it off. Yeah, I was in the Army from 46 to 48.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I did basic training in Georgia, and then off to Texas, and then up to Oregon, where we left. And I encountered my first ride on a big boat, and my first experience of what a typhoon looks like over the Pacific Ocean.
Oh my goodness.
It's very exciting.
All right, well, excuse me for interrupting you.
No, certainly. That's fine. I don't want to just bore you to death with
details. No, that's quite all right.
When I had decided to go to Sweden, I had a sister living in New York City. And so my mother accompanied me out to New York City with the idea of putting me on a boat to go to Sweden. And it took about 10 days to find a boat, to get passage on a boat going to Sweden. Well, it was going to England. And in the process, we sort of walked around New York City. We had been there in 1938 when my mother did a graduate course at Columbia, so we knew a little bit about New York, Manhattan. And I can't remember why we ended up on 68th Street, New York Avenue. But as you may know, 68th Street and York Avenue is this wonderful intersection where Cornell Medical College and what has become Rockefeller University and Sloan Kettering Memorial Hospital are all located. And I was out there. I think my mother must have planned this because she told me later, some years later, that she had read about this situation in Time magazine. But we were walking by the front door of Memorial Sloan Kettering, and I had written my master's thesis on cancer cells. And my mother said, well, this is a cancer research institute. Why don't you go and see what it's like? So I went in, and there was a receptionist at the front desk, and I said, well, I'm a graduate student, and I'm really interested in working with cells. Is there any way I could do anything here? And she said, well, I don't know, just hold on a minute. And she got on the telephone, and within, I think, literally seconds, I was on the top floor in the director's office, and he was telling me that that very week, they had signed a contract with Cornell Medical College to be the graduate division for medical sciences of Cornell Medical College. And they were looking for a graduate student.
David, your mother had ESP.
So I said, oh yeah, well, but I'm on my way to Sweden. What can I do about that? And he said, well, that's perfect because it'll take us quite some time to get the administration of this project put together. So we'll wait for you when you come back. Just come directly to us. And in the meantime, I was assigned to John Beasley, who was running a tissue culture lab. And he was to be my major professor. So we communicated over the year while I was in Sweden and developed an approach to what research I would do when I came back. Boy, talk about serendipity. I returned there and set right in to work. And very shortly, I was told that they had just set up an electron microscope laboratory in the building. And I had had a little experience of the first electron microscopes trying to look at bacteria at the University of Michigan. Robin Williams, who was the lead researcher in the engineering school doing electron microscopy, had showed me his facility. And then in Sweden, I got in with Fritjof Sjöstrand there and saw their electron microscope facility and began to think that light microscopes were a bore and really wanted to get an electron microscope and look at cells. So I had a research project at Sloan Kettering that was not electron microscopic. I was doing biochemistry, isolating cell fractions. And I decided, well, nobody's looked at the cell fractions to tell what's in there, so why don't I do that? So I did, and that turned out to be by far the most productive part of what I did in research there. And it attracted the attention of Keith Porter and George Pilati, who were working at Rockefeller across the street at the time, who were very enthusiastic about what I was doing. Well, October of 1950, I had just been in that lab for since August. And in October, on the 1st of October, John Beasley, my major professor, had already four or five young technicians, but a new one was hired. And for some reason, I was working entirely in cold rooms at the time, isolating cell fractions, terrible occupation. But for some reason, they brought her in and introduced her to me, and that was Marilyn, of course. And We didn't connect at all until February, and then from then on it was uphill or downhill. It was in a very excellent direction. So we were married in 52. I told her I would never agree to marry anyone until I had completed my PhD.
Now, how did your mother like this?
she was mortified. She kept telling me she's not pretty enough, she's not this enough, not that enough, and none of that made any difference to me at all. I knew I had come upon a wonderful event in my life, and but then I remember one time when my mother was telling me how terrible Marilyn was. I said, yes, but she graduated from Wellesley. And my mother just stopped in the middle of the sentence. And from then on, it was okay. So, so yeah, we were married. And I had applied for a postdoctoral fellowship from American Cancer Society. And it was awarded. And it was awarded on the basis that I would come out here and work with Harold Rush. Well, with people in McArdle. And so I came out to make the arrangements for that. I had some experience I had followed Van Potter's work closely and was very much interested in that. And I had been interested in the kind of things David Green was doing. And so I came out here to make arrangements for the postdoc. And Harold Rush was very kind, and he said, yes, and now you're going to work as a technician for Hank Gilardi. And the first thing we want you to do is take a course in physical chemistry. And I was a very arrogant young PhD, and I thought, how come you're making me start taking courses all over again? I thought I had done that. So I said, no, I wouldn't come. And appealed to ACS to allow me to transfer the postdoctoral fellowship. The microscope at Sloan Kettering in those years, the electron microscope, actually belonged to NYU biochemistry department. And so I thought, well, I'll just go down to NYU, which I did.
You go ahead.
Yeah. That was a very strange anatomy department. My degree read anatomy because Cornell at the time didn't have anything called cell. And when I said that I was, I think we were still calling it cell physiology at the time. When I said I'm a cell physiologist, they said, well, you can't graduate in that because we don't offer degrees in that. So, well, you can graduate in anatomy. Maybe that's the closest to what you're doing. So my degree read anatomy, and the electron microscope was being transferred back down to NYU, but to the anatomy department. So that's where the postdoctoral fellowship went. And it's the craziest department I've ever been in my life. I had to teach gross anatomy, histology. I was supposed to learn neuroanatomy, which I had never had before, and I had to set up a new electron microscope laboratory and get it running and do some research. Well, it was a severe overload, as you might imagine. And it turned out that several of the people in the department were really not particularly normal human beings. The chairman of the department was in love with the chief neuroanatomist in the department, and he was married to a lesbian and they had agreed not to take their partners into their home. But after I left NYU, just to emphasize how crazy the situation was, the year after I left, his wife brought her woman partner into the house And he killed her with a butcher knife and then murdered and then suicided himself. So it was
my goodness gracious.
A weird kind of department.
Weird.
So and I couldn't get very much done because I had this heavy teaching load and responsibility for an EM lab. And so I was really getting nervous that I couldn't publish enough to get out.
All right, let's pause here and turn the tape over.
I did get involved with some other biochemists there doing research, this time in collagen, connective tissue. And at NYU, I had really met Homer Smith and a whole bunch of wonderful, really high-level scientists. Linus Pauling was around frequently. And it was a very mixed experience. But I was, by my third year there, I was getting really worried about getting out. Marilyn's family lived in West Newton, outside of Boston, Massachusetts. And we were there for Christmas one time. And we happened to be looking in a jewelry store window. And I never did buy her that diamond. Anyway, we were looking in a jewelry store window, and a guy came up to me and asked who I was. And he said, well, how would you like to come back to Cornell and teach gross anatomy for me? And it was Don Fawcett. So I said, yeah, I'd like to do that. So I went right away up there. And it seemed like a funny compromise because when I went to NYU, I had never had gross anatomy. Didn't know that I was terribly interested in gross, but I was obliged to teach it. So they gave me a little room and a cadaver. The class had already started, and they told me I had 2 weeks to get ahead of the class, and then start teaching. So that's how I learned gross anatomy. And I was forever grateful to medical students because they were very generous. I didn't know anything about gross anatomy, but I was teaching it ostensibly. So it was kind of strange to go back to Cornell to teach gross anatomy. But I welcomed the opportunity, and Fawcett had a very active and productive group working in electron microscopy. So it was an ideal research arrangement for me. So I went up there, stayed 4 years at Cornell in the anatomy department, and then Fawcett was called back to Harvard to chair the department in Harvard. And I had wanted to get back to the Middle West, so I said, I'm going to the Middle West. And he said, well, okay, you're going to the Middle West. So I went to a anatomy meeting in Seattle and displayed my research, and several people invited me to come and look, and one of them was John Anderson, who was representing Otto Mortensen at the meeting, looking for an assistant professor to come here. And I thought, well, I've been wanting to go and work someplace close with Van Potter all this time and with David Green and all those interesting people. So I agreed to do that. We had by the time, that was 1959, spring of 59, we had by that time 2 little girls, and we were getting nervous about them growing up in New York City. We were living out in Flushing on Queens, which was better than Manhattan for that, for our family. But and Marilyn was thinking it would be interesting to go to the Middle West. She thought I would go to St. Paul, so she, even to this day, will sometimes say, how come you promised me St. Paul and I got Madison instead? Well, I keep telling her, you're very lucky, because Madison Medical School here was far, far better than St. Paul. But anyway, so we came out with 2 children. Marilyn was pregnant with our 3rd child, and that turned out to be a boy. And I went to work in the anatomy department. I was still teaching gross anatomy and histology both. And they had just gotten electron microscope. So again, I was in the same situation of having to set up a new EM facility and teach in two of the heaviest courses in the department. So that went on for a little while when, I guess it went on for about 2 or 3 years, and then they let me out of gross anatomy to continue my work with cells. So that's pretty much the way things went for us. We, sort of in the middle of that time, in the fall of 1963, Marilyn was pregnant with our fourth child, turned out to be a son, Peter. Around the time, I guess that was the year that Kennedy was killed, and around the time of his assassination, Marilyn fell ill with what appeared to be some kind of a pneumonia. And we asked Helen Dickey to have a look at her. And Helen said, well, it isn't pneumonia, it's tuberculosis. So she said, it looks like a very light case. And if it weren't for the little children and her pregnancy, I would just say, stay at home and we'll treat you. But since you have these young children in the family, I'm going to send her to the sanatorium. So Marilyn went over there for 3 months. Yeah, I guess a little more than 3 months. In fact, Peter's, our son's birth was sort of what brought her out on a snowy night. And then they decided they didn't need to send her back. She was all right. That was a very interesting time, trying to teach two classes and run a EM lab and have three little children at home. So, so we, the people in our church at the time, were very helpful with providing caretakers for me. So that also forced us into a decision to finally move out of university houses and get into a house of our own. So, it, you know, with all bad things, there seemed to be some good things that happened too. Well, things went along pretty well. In 66, Otto announced that he was going to retire. Otto Mortensen was chair, had been for some time. And one of the person with whom I had the closest association was Harlan Mossman, and I had always been interested in developmental anatomy as well. So that was a strong connection, and we did a little bit of work together. But when he was not interested in following Otto as chair of the department, so Otto did a really strange thing, and I have very strong feelings about this. He did what I think was a very strange thing. He said, I'm going to retire next year, and I'd like everybody in the department to write a statement for me about what they think the future of the department should be. I wrote one, and nobody else in the department wrote one. And I'm afraid that's why they made me take the chair. And I thought that, well, I was young enough at the time that I thought, well, you know, maybe I should do this and turn this into a really exciting department. But it was not a good idea. But it fell to me to do that. So I did serve as chair then until 82, when I finally got courage enough to quit. I did not like being chair of the department. The first few years were kind of fun, but I was very heavily burdened by the department's past and its unwillingness to move in a new direction. And I happened to come in the years when money was getting more and more difficult, and I could never match what the faculty thought they ought to be paid because I just didn't get enough money to do that. My very first day as chair in the department, I got a call from the dean to go downstairs and lock the doors on Linden Drive because there was tear gas in the street. And they were afraid that protesters would come running into Bardeen Labs. Well, I did that, but it was sort of symbolic of the kind of pressure the department was going to be under. And I think the school, for that matter, the whole university was under a lot of pressure in those years.
Who was the dean?
The dean when I came was John Bowers. And I think he was still dean. I think he was followed by Peter Eichmann, wasn't he? I think so. And I don't believe Peter was dean yet. No, that's not true. That's not true. It must have been Peter. Yeah, it was Peter Eichmann. Yeah. Because Bowers got in trouble before then.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can't remember when he left, but he was here in 56, and so this would have been 60.
Yeah,
he was gone by then.
See,
sure.
I would have, that day would have been 67.
Oh, heavens, he
was
long gone.
When I became chair. And Peter, I know that Peter was dean when I made professor.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even when I made associate. I can't remember that for sure. I would say I shouldn't say, because I can't remember for sure what the dates were. But as I think about it, I do remember that it was Peter who was dean at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I survived, I think. That's probably not the right verb, but I think I had experience of 11 deans before I retired. There was something really strange about the medical school. Do you remember those years when
just
had one dean right after another? And the politics was unbearable. And people hated Tony Carreri, or they loved Tony Carreri, and it was a very politically.
It was a war zone.
Wow, it was something else. Yeah, it was. And I think that worked very heavily to the disadvantage of all of us. I think it was really, I think I was not entirely aware of how damaging it was until lots of years later, but it was very damaging. Anyway, to make a long story short, you will notice that what happened to me is why I so regret having taken the chair. In my efforts to change the direction of the department, I simply became an administrator. And I didn't like being an administrator. And it wasn't doing anything for my career. In fact, it ended my research career. That is, it ended my publishing career. You see a whole page of committees, and the reason I leave those in my curriculum is because it says what happened to me. And I remember one year in particular when I counted 17 committees that I was obliged to serve and chair some of them, and it was much too burdensome. I never stopped doing research, and I just stopped publishing. But I always managed to get a little money to keep my stuff going. I worked with, largely with rats or invertebrate animals that didn't cost anything. So I kept my research going and actually changed things quite a bit. And was able to really enlarge upon the electron microscope facility that we had, and became very much involved with the development of electron microscopes, and worked with people in electrical engineering and in geology in the development of microscopes. I was a major player in getting a high voltage electron microscope for the campus, and the person whose name I can't say right now, who was chairing the NIH department that was funding microscopes at the time, was a close friend of mine, and so we managed to get the first million volt electron microscope on our campus as an experiment. I think the experiment failed. I don't think high voltage electron microscopy ever added very much. And I was much more interested in developing analytical procedures for regular electron microscopes. And those have become quite valuable because they permit chemical analysis of the image, of the material producing the image. So that was much fun. And I got very much involved with a group of people who were developing atomic force microscopes and various other kinds of microscopy. So I kept my hand in all the time, but by 82 I was really fed to the teeth, and I got out.
I noticed you got out. You went away.
Yes, well, I called on some of my friends from my time in Cornell and asked who was doing research that I might get involved with. They suggested I go and work with Dan Branton, who had moved to chair the biolabs at Harvard. And he was very reluctant to let me come, said he had more postdocs than he could deal with, and if I needed to learn how to do stuff, I'd have to learn it from his postdocs. So I said, okay, I'll do that. That was not a very smart move, but I did go away for a year. Marilyn stayed here and built a house for us in the Arboretum, and we just kept sending blueprints back and forth, but she did all of the real work to build the house while I was gone. I learned a lot of cell biological techniques working with Dan Branton. He put me on a project that two other people had failed on, and in the end I convinced him that it was a bad project, couldn't be done, and it never has been done. So that was kind of, except that I learned stuff, I didn't come away with anything to show for it. So I spent the last of that year away at Harvard Medical School, where I did have a lot of friends, and still do. And more or less fell back into the kind of electron microscopy I had been doing, but with a much heavier biochemical component to it. So it was a productive year. I regret having been away all that time. But yeah, it worked and it didn't work. It set me up for a lot of other stuff that I could do here with microscope development. But I had begun by that time, especially after being for a year at Harvard in the biolabs, I suddenly began to like the idea of educational psychology. And so for those last years in the department, from five or so, until I retired in 94, I got very involved with, we hired a computer programmer to work with us in developing microscopic anatomy, computer-assisted microscopic anatomy. We didn't want to get rid of microscopes entirely. And we worked very hard at that, and I set up a small ad hoc group. Susan Skorchelek still thinks that was a fun thing to do, where we talked educational philosophy and educational psychology and how we could influence the medical school and our own departments to engage with these concepts. So that was that really occupied much of my time during the last few years in the department, until 94, when I finally retired.
Were there other departments that became involved in this? I assume this was a teaching concept?
The clinical people seemed to be much more interested than the basic science people in doing what we were doing. I did develop a pretty strong relationship with people in physiology who were quite interested in it. I think it actually did affect what they did quite a bit. But I can't tell how effective it was in spreading through the school. I had been on the curriculum committee almost all of my career, and I was always fighting in the committee because I so frequently did not agree with the way things were being taught, the amount of time devoted to subjects and the way they were being presented, and the enormous number of important things that were being left out because they were crowded out by things I thought physicians probably didn't need anymore. I think that I brought those concepts to the curriculum committee, especially in those last years, and I think it had some effect. Chuck Lobeck and I regularly locked horns on these issues, but in the end, I think pretty much agreed. And Chuck sort of carried that attitude forward, especially with clinical people. And Ted, what is Ted's name? Boy, this old brain is forgetting things. Anyway, one of the guys, we were always on opposite sides, and I, in no way could I claim that I always won arguments on the curriculum committee, not even close, but I think I did challenge them, and I think that they did pick up some of what I, and that's not fair, not just me, but what our little group was trying to promote. So, I really got, though I swore as a young man that I would never want to teach anybody anything, I really got to liking being involved with education in the end. So it was a very long journey to get there. Let me just say a few words about what happened to me after I retired.
Before you do that,
yeah.
You have a sheet here of that I thought was extremely interesting, and I'd like all of it on the record. And I think what I'm going to do is to start another tape so that we can finish these things on a fresh tape.
I am just rambling on.
This is not rambling. This is excellent. David Slaughterback. David, you've put together a sheet here about your research interests throughout your career, and I really want to get this on the record. Your your major interest was in cell differentiation. Mm-hmm. And do you want to elaborate on that?
Yes, I think I got started in that direction because my grandmother died of breast cancer, and I had wondered what that meant. And when I became educated enough to understand what cells were and to develop a lifelong interest in cells, in those years when I was just beginning in research, we didn't really know very much about cells or how they went through the elaborate process of differentiation into specific cell types. But it was beginning to be clear that that process was somehow distorted when cells became malignant. And so, really early in my educational years, I got very interested in developmental anatomy, embryology, because it was one of the places where cell differentiation was obvious, because you had to go from one cell type to dozens of cell types and more. And so people had been looking at differentiating systems in embryonic animals and plants, for that matter, too. So I rapidly put these things together, my interest in cells and having some experience with cancer, wrote my master's thesis on cancer research, and the change in intracellular components during the process of a specialization of cell types. And looking at those with a light microscope in the 40s, you couldn't see very much. It was largely guesswork about what was going on inside the cells. And this was just more challenge than I could stand. I just had to know what was going on in those cells as they moved from an undifferentiated, generalized cell type to a highly specialized one. And all of my time, that has been the guiding issue for me throughout, well, till today. I just love trying to figure out what in the world is going on in those cells that make them do these strange things. You see, when I started, I'm sure you'll remember this situation, nobody had the foggiest idea what DNA was for. We knew there were nucleic acids, and that's about all. And we knew there was such a thing as a Golgi complex, but all we knew was that it stained black with silver. We didn't know what it was or what it did or anything. We didn't even know there was a thing like endoplasmic reticulum, which I spent a lot of my life working on. Those intracellular components were simply not known, and no one knew what they did. Mitochondria had been isolated, and there was a pretty good idea about what mitochondria did, but not much about how they did it, or when they did it, or why they did it. So the very first thing that I did, really, was to take the cell fractions I was studying biochemically and just have a look and see what they were. And by a jolly coincidence, Keith Porter had just a very few years before described the what he called endoplasmic reticulum. He couldn't see it really because he was looking at through tissue culture cells, which were much too thick to get any clear image from, but you could see that there was something there. And so then when I isolated membranes from normal and from hepatomas, normal liver cells and and cancerous liver cells. I could see it was an endoplasmic reticulum, and Keith and I hit that off right away. But so it's this business of trying to identify the components in a cell and see what it is about them that permits the process of cell differentiation, and what may be distorted when the cell goes awry and becomes malignant instead. That's just been why I've done everything that I've done.
Well, this is why you were so involved in the acquisition and the development of the various microscopes.
There was a very small group of people in the early 1950s when I was working on my degree who were involved in trying to see whether electron microscopes could be useful in biological systems. And they were mostly based at MIT and at the Rockefeller, which still was not a university at the time, but just a research institute. I think it was just unbelievably exciting to get involved with those people. And our electron microscopes in the 50s were a disaster. They were terrible, and they were sort of jerry-rigged. And, you know, there were multiple iron core lenses to make the electromagnetic lens, and we always had a rubber mallet when we were working on the microscopes, because you had very fine holes through these lenses that the electrons had to pass through, and aligning all the little holes through the multiple lenses in the column of the microscope was a terrible task. And so you'd stand there and you'd bang on the column this way and watch the hole move that way and bang on it the other way and pray a lot to get the darn things to work. I remember the day we first saw an electron microscope where you could move the apertures in these lenses around by turning screws on the outside of the column instead of banging on it with a mallet. Well, it was terribly exciting, and it was a time when every single time that you sat down to work in the electron microscope, you saw something nobody had ever seen before at all, any place, any time. And getting caught up in all of that was just a fantastic time for me. And so I stayed with microscope development until I retired, actually. I didn't do much of the engineering. I was mostly on the side of people who were telling the engineers what we had to have.
And who did the engineering? Was it something like General Electric, or was it all done in the laboratory?
A lot of it was done in the companies, mostly in the Japanese companies. Mm-hmm. American companies got out of the business very quickly. Dutch Philips microscopes were probably the best microscopes, at least during my career. Some of the Japanese microscopes got to be very good, and they invested a lot in research. So their microscopes moved right along. And here on our campus, I worked with a variety of people. I think in the last years, I worked a lot with Tom Kelly and Jill. Can't say Jill's last name over in geology. I worked with quite a few of those people, and they would make changes on their microscopes, and then we'd look at them with our stuff and say whether that was better or worse, and try to make suggestions from our own limited knowledge of electronics. But I was never involved in trying to lay out the circuitry. Myself, I didn't think that was where my expertise lay. But I was always engaged with engineers of one kind or another. But in those very first years, I was very much involved with the very people who did make the first electron microscopes. And I'm repeating myself. All that was
fun. Were the first. You were the first to do a few things yourself.
Yeah.
First to characterize the subcellular isolates as endoplasmic reticular membrane.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever that is.
The endoplasmic reticulum?
Yes.
I did this when I was, I was quite heavily involved with endoplasmic reticulum. I only came involved with Golgi complex later on. It's surprising how specialized you can get in the field of cell research, because I think it must have taken me 15 years or so before I really did very much work with the Golgi complex. I was very much involved with, in the beginning, with rough endoplasmic reticulum, because it was the first evidence of differentiation in the cells that I was studying. And I was studying cells in Hydra. Hydra had a long history of being used to study cell differentiation because it has a limited number of cell types. And because you can start it from an egg or you can start it from a bud, there's a lot of things you can do with it. And best of all, it was small enough animal to preserve well and cut into very thin sections for the electron microscope.
Is a hydra a snake?
No, it's a little invertebrate. It's about centimeter and a half long.
Uh-huh.
And they live right here in our lakes. So I could go out and catch my own hydra.
Oh,
so I didn't
my.
Have to have big research grants for that. But there's a very large literature on differentiation in hydra. They're close relatives of corals. There is one marine hydra, but it's very few of them. So I was quite involved with people who were working with corals as well, but I never did corals myself. Corals are not much good for electron microscope because they have too much calcium or silica in them, so they wreck your knife when you try to cut thin sections.
Was this sort of the beginnings of stem cell research?
Well, it's very like that, because that's exactly what you do with stem cells. Take a undifferentiated cell and make it differentiate. I couldn't do that when we were studying differentiate. I couldn't make it do something. I could only watch what it did. So I had to be very selective in the kind of cells that I chose to work on. And soon after I published on this business about endoplasmic reticulum is the vesicular system which is responsible for protein synthesis and is especially highly developed in secretory cells. And a friend of mine, about a year after I published, he came out with the same report for thyroid cells. And he was able to show that rough endoplasmic reticulum was responsible for the development of protein synthesis in those cells. So that was a wonderful confirmation of our two different approaches to one aspect of cell differentiation. So I got a little off track when I went into microtubules, but I was seeing these things in cells that I was studying, and they were particularly highly elaborated into structures. The microtubules would be assembled in an array that would make a structure inside the cell. So I kept coming on them, and I thought I would just publish about seeing them and what I thought they might be doing. that shows you the way politics work. Keith Porter had been a big friend of mine, and it was, always was. He some few years older than I, and he had made, established a really important career for himself in cell studies, and I was up with visiting a friend in Yale, and I said, I'm going to publish on microtubules. I think these are really important things. I'm even going to call them organelles, which at the time we thought was a way of saying, the naming something that was essential to the life of the cell. And that was Sandy Paley, who was very famous for his work in neuroanatomy with electron microscopes. And Sandy said, I don't think you should do that. I said, come on, I'm going to do it. They're tremendously interesting organelles. And he said, I know. But Keith said he was going to win a Nobel laureate on those tubules, but he's not ready to talk about them yet. So I said, well, that's, you know, he can do whatever he wants to, and so can I. So I went home and wrote this paper about microtubules, and I sent it into the Journal of Cell Biology, of which he was editor. And he sat on it, and he wouldn't publish it, and he wouldn't publish it. And I finally got to writing him saying, are you going to publish my paper one of these times, or send it back to me, or what? Oh, we're going to publish it. Well, of course, he waited until his paper was ready. But he did allow me the issue before his. We're in the same volume now after all these years. But we happened to have the Anatomy Association meeting here that very next year in Madison. And I said, Keith, come for a walk around the square with me. And we went out and walked around the square, and I said, Keith, I know why you did that. Oh, what do you mean, Dave? Oh, what do you mean? And finally he said, well, yes, I did. But he said, you know, we really thought they belonged to us. And I said, well, you always told me no subject belonged to any one person. Anybody's entitled to work on anything. Well, he went to some lengths to make amends, but he finally conceded that that's what he had done. But I have to say that my paper got quoted more often than his, so maybe,
and he didn't get the
maybe
Nobel.
It was fair enough.
Yeah. And he didn't get the Nobel?
No, he didn't get the Nobel. He never did get a Nobel. In fact, George Pilati, who did get the Nobel for very much the same work, in fact, for the work he did when he was a student of Keith Porter's, and almost everybody, it was really too bad that Keith died without a Nobel laureate, because he wanted it so badly. His student got it, and he didn't.
Oh, dear.
Oh well, that's the way science is.
Is there anything more you'd like to say about your research?
Oh, I think that's probably more than I should have said. I did, at the end, get very much involved in receptor-mediated endocytosis, and I think that I do regret that I couldn't get to a level with that research that I felt I could publish, because I think it was going extremely well, but time ran out, and this is maybe private, but I wrote some grant applications in the last 2 years of my career based on receptor-mediated endocytosis, and I didn't get those grants paid, and when I asked for the reviews, it was plain that they hadn't read my grant application except for the executive summary, and I was accused of things of not doing things that were in, that were in the explanation of the grant, but they hadn't read it. So we had some talks about ageism, because I was pretty old by that time, but it never came to anything. So, but I enjoyed that research, and even though it never really came to a publication. And I think I've said more about that than I should.
Well, that was an unfortunate for them.
Happens.
And so you retired.
So I retired. I got involved with the AARP because I was saying to Marilyn that I was kind of casting around. I knew some things I wanted to do in retirement. And she said, well, Marilyn had been very much involved in long-term care with her job in DHFS. She said, well, you have a background
DHFS.
Department of Health and Family Services. Mm-hmm. Used to be called Health and Social Services,
right.
Didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so she said, well, you have some experience and connections in the medical profession, so why don't you go and see whether you can do anything with the AARP? So I went in, and it was another one of these situations where you walk in the door and a vacuum draws you into the heart of it immediately. When I said I was interested in working on health, they said, oh, well, gee, the chair of our subcommittee on health is just resigned. So I got involved with them as an advocate, and I was their chief lobbyist for 6 years, and we accomplished quite a lot. I learned to work with legislators. I had never done any lobbying before in my life, had any idea what to do about it. I am by preference a politically liberal person, but I found that I worked most effectively with the Republican legislators, and I particularly enjoyed working with Greg Underheim, whom a lot of people don't like, but he would always want me to come over and talk about what is the role of government in health, and I would say, well, I'll come and talk about that if you'll pass this bill. I developed a really nice situation there. We got some really good things done. We wrote the law, the statute, and the rule on residential care apartment complexes. We passed one of the first bills in the country on consumer protection in healthcare. I got very much involved in the startup of long-term care redesign, the steering committee there, and was appointed by the governor to the Long-Term Care Council, which was given responsibility for all long-term care in the state. It's a policy council. It didn't do anything, but made decisions, and that was a very rewarding experience. That began to come apart because AARP reorganized, and they were getting very nervous that volunteers were doing things they didn't agree with, and so I was displaced by a hired professional lobbyist from Chicago who didn't know anything at all about Wisconsin, and the first dumb thing he did was to stand up with Chuck Quala. And the Republicans said, no way are we working with AARP anymore. And that was a very tough decision. But I stayed with those for another 2 years, functioning as sort of a liaison person with the Patient Safety Institute, another medical long-term care organization that Louise Trubeck had put together. I think you know Louise in the law school.
No.
She has been a major player in health law. And I finally got on to the, well, I was on several other such organizations that were involved in health and long-term care. Mm-hmm. And that was fun. It sort of wound down a year and a half ago when the reorganization in AARP had been largely completed, and I was out of sympathy with what they were doing, and I think they were out of sympathy with what I was doing. Mm-hmm. So we parted company amicably. That was all right. I'd been there 8 years. That was long enough. You're supposed to only get 2-year appointments and not more than 3 of them, so that they let me stay on an extra 2 years, I thought was supposed to be a reward for good behavior or something. I don't know what it was. I'm still on some of those. There is a new long-term care council. Now it's called Reform Council. And I'm on a subcommittee of that on residential care options. And that's very much the part of long-term care I had been doing anyway. So that's
Is
that's
this fun. Part of AARP?
No, nope, this is part of the DHFS. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Helene Nelson's a longtime friend of us, so that mm-hmm. works well. I had been out less than a year when Marianne Thompson, you know her?
Yes.
Yeah. I had joined Plato, and she put together a tour for one of the classes to go through the museums. And I went through the Madison Art Center, and a young woman docent was showing us around, and I thought, gosh, I can do that. So I signed on for training there and a little later at LVM, and I have been doing that now since 95, and so it's almost 10 years. Well, it'll be 10 years next year. And I take great pleasure out of doing that. And I guess I sometimes wonder, what is a cell biologist doing way off here looking at contemporary art? I've always been interested in art. It wasn't exactly a new thing. As I told you, the Art Institute in Chicago was one of the first places I ever got to know. And my last years in medical school, I had become very much interested in a different way of teaching. So I guess it sort of fell together. And they liked the way I did tours, so I still do them. And
you're going to have a year and a half or so off from
No, I'm afraid not.
No?
No.
Aren't they moving?
Yes.
Are they going to set up shop someplace else? Well,
almost all of their art is in cases in Chicago, mm-hmm. in a warehouse. But they saved out several pieces, which are a traveling exhibition through elementary and high schools in the school district. Well, actually through Dane County. And so we will be traveling out to schools. I go out next Monday for the first time. This time to be shown around how it works, and then soon after we'll start actually going out to art classes and behaving as docents in high schools and elementary schools. And this summer we are being assigned to work at the Olbrich Gardens, where they're going to be sculptural and installations, art installations. And we're supposed to be involved with that.
Wonderful.
That's going to need some training. And most of us are pretty scared because these are things we haven't done before. But I figure if you ever go to sleep, your brain will die in no time. So I like to keep my brain challenged. And this will really do it.
Well, you don't have a lot of spare time, I can see.
No, and I did also learn to sculpt, and I'm really sorry. I got several good classes of sculpting after I retired, and I still do some sculpting in clay, but it's hard to make connection with sculpture has moved strongly toward installations, and I'm not very comfortable with installations. I will do some of them if I have to, but I don't want to do them. So I've had a hard time keeping that going. I'm not about to hire a young woman to come to my house and undress so I can sculpt her. So, it's a little difficult. But I love to sculpt, and I do it when I can. And I do some,
quickly for me. This is side two, tape two with Dr. Slaughterback. And you wanted to talk more about what you've done since you retired.
Yeah, just a little bit about that. I grew up Quaker without a Quaker meeting until I got to college, where I got involved with Quaker meetings. And so I've sort of been involved with religion off and on. When we first came here, we were in the Congregational Church, and that suited us very nicely till they got a new minister who told me it was all right to lie as long as it served God appropriately. And I thought, that's not where I came from. So we got out of that. And we didn't really go back to doing anything with religion until I returned from my research leave at Harvard. And then we thought, let's try again. And Marilyn wanted us to try as many churches in Madison as we could, and we did. And we came on First Methodist Church rather late in that process, and the man who was preaching at the time, his name is Kenneth Engelman, and Marilyn was especially attracted by his rather more intellectual and analytical approach. And he soon retired, was replaced by David Lyons, who had a very strong inclination to that intellectual and analytical approach to theology. And he set up a little program in the church, which was first called Science and Theology. And we tried to attract other scientists than just David Slaughterback, and we got a few. But he was afraid that we were keeping people away who weren't interested in science, so he changed the name to Faith and Reason. And I told him that was a god-awful thing to do, words chosen intentionally, because the Pope had just produced an encyclical called Faith and Reason. I thought people would get the wrong idea of who we are. But that developed very strongly into a group of people who have a rather open mind on theology, and are somehow, to some extent, engaged with a thing known as the Jesus Seminar. That's a national organization of scholars who are trying to understand the first century better, and in particular the historical Jesus, who that person was or wasn't or whatever. So I've gotten quite involved with that, and that David Lyons retired in 2000 and abruptly died of a vasectomy aneurysm in 2002, December. So he had talked to the congregation a couple of times about how he thought the church desperately needed something like a visiting professorship or lecture series. So I asked two of the people in our Faith and Reason group, if they didn't think this would be a good time to try and produce the lectureship that David had always wanted, David Lyons had always wanted. And he had talked to one of my friends within 2 weeks of his death about now it was time to finally try to put this thing together, and then he died. So we thought, well, it's a good time for us to try and put it together. So we have. We got the church's approval, and we have our first speaker coming on the 24th of this month. And he is John Dominic Crossan, who is a very famous, well-known theologian who writes about first century and about who the historical, who was the person, Jesus of Nazareth, and whether that matters or not, and all that lovely kind of stuff that never has any real answers. So he's coming, and then I have already committed our group to Elaine Pagels, who will come next year in April. And she has most recently written a book called Beyond Belief that has attracted an enormous amount of attention. So we think we'll get a pretty big audience next year. So I like this subject and have done a lot of reading about it. I approach it, frankly, as a cell biologist, mucking around in theology, and I say to the people in our group that, when they ask me, that one of the things that a life in science taught me was that all truths are relative, that the endoplasmic reticulum I described today is going to be wrong, and I know it's going to be wrong because some guy will come along and do a better job because he knows more and it's got more instruments than I had and whatever. So it's so common amongst biological scientists, at least, to say to each other, well, I'm just standing on the shoulders of the guy before me. And is there an ultimate truth? I don't know. But I know that what I know about cell biology today is going to be largely wrong in a year or so. Some parts of it will be wrong, and maybe some won't be. So I became very accustomed, and the other scientists in our group say they feel the same way. I live comfortably with uncertainty. I do not have to have absolutes around. Uncertainty is just fine with me because it means, it's like studying differentiation. It means that things are moving toward better understanding all along. And if I make a little contribution here and there, that's okay. If I don't, that's okay too. But it's what interests me about, as a cell biologist, about being engaged with theology, because I try to understand it a little better this year than I did last year. I know I'll never come to the end of it, and I think if I did, I'd be dead. So, I mean, what else is there? If you come to the end, I guess that's where death is. So that's what I do.
Well, that's very interesting. You certainly don't have a lot of time on your hands.
Well, I try not
to. You're doing some very interesting things.
Yes, I didn't even tell you we're on this Dane County United. And I should tell you that because you may know Phil Lewis. Do you know Phil Lewis?
I knew him.
Yeah. He's I'm on a subcommittee that's working on land use and transportation. Mm-hmm. You and I are working together on that. That's a whole other bag of tricks.
That is.
So when
and
one
that's
of these
a developing
runs
challenge
course,
as well.
when that's done, I'll try to have to think of something else to stay
yes,
busy.
Yes, well, I'm sure you will. Well, Dr. Slaughterback, this has been very, very interesting. Thank you
My
so
pleasure.
Much for taking time.
Imagine
we
talking about yourself for all that.